Welcome to Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell, and I'm very glad you're with us. I mean, there's so much happening throughout the world that every time you get a chance to maybe pick up some information or hear some opinions from people who spend their lifetime literally studying these events, it's a good opportunity, and none better than this week. I've been chronicling the Chinese influence in Canada for really a number of years after the lead of people like Terry Glavin. Well, we have the person who I think is the foremost expert on this. Sam Cooper is going to be with us, and I'm really looking forward to it. I think you're going to be shocked at the degree to which we've got organized gangs from China. We've got the fentanyl drug problem. We've got money laundering, and all linked back to the Communist Party of China. I think this one is going to literally disabuse anybody who thought that the kind of Chinese threat was overblown. By the way, Sam is the author of the top book I said last year, Willful Blindness, How a Network of Narcos, Tycoons, and CCP Agents Infiltrated the West. And man, starting with Canada, we'll do that coming up. I've also got Mark Brown with me. He's on the ground when it comes to what's happening in the commodity markets, especially though when you talk about copper or you talk about gold, silver, etc. I'm looking forward to that because I want to know exactly what their perspective is after the Ukraine invasion and the sanctions. I want to know what the pressures are when you try and get a mine up and started, because we know for renewables, we are definitely going to need more things like lithium and copper and nickel. And of course, we've had those problems in the nickel market. But I've also got Ozzy, and I've got Victor, and I've got Michael Levy. It's all coming your way. And I hope you stay tuned for the goofy. I think it's an excellent one. But first off, if the energy crisis wasn't so serious, I think it would be laughable. I mean, just 7 months ago at COP26, we had elites, celebrities on their yachts, their private jets, leaders from all Western nations committing to ending fossil fuel subsidies. But now, look around. It's incredible. We've got the US, we've got Germany, UK, Italy, Netherlands, Austria, Japan, South Korea, France. Even California are all implementing subsidies for gasoline and other fossil fuels. You know, it's interesting. Juxtapose that with this week, the International Energy Agency issued a 10-point plan to reduce gasoline and diesel and other fossil fuel demand. But now we got these jurisdictions are putting in subsidies and tax breaks to make sure consumers don't have to curtail demand. Look at California. What an example. Spending $9 billion that directly supports consumer demand for gasoline. And the tax goes to anyone who owns a vehicle registered in California, whether they're worth $10 billion or 10 cents. You know what? That's 12 times more than their subsidy they're now offering to take public transit. And this is from a governor who paints himself so green that he makes leprechauns look pale. Come on, it's a good bet that Vladimir Putin is happy that consumption will continue. After all, he has an invasion to finance. But talk about governments trying to solve a problem that their own policies created. 8 years of regulations and talk discouraging oil and gas production. Well, it worked. Capital investments fallen off a cliff. Production can't keep up with rising demand, and presto, prices go up. And let me repeat, rising energy prices were obvious well before Russia invaded Ukraine. The sanctions just further exposed and exacerbated a problem that already existed. As I said, it would be laughable if the failure of leadership to understand the basics of the supply and demand didn't have such serious consequences. But actually, it's more than just supply and demand. I think it's the failure to see the coming crisis, which exposes, I think, a superficiality of thinking. And I think it's the main characteristic of political discourse about every aspect of the economy. Look, I've been studying economics, finance, investment for over 50 years. I experienced the ups and downs of owning, well, it's a good-sized business. I've had the wonderful opportunity to talk to numerous brilliant thinkers on the front lines of business and finance, and I've never been more concerned. It's not just about the lack of sophistication on the part of our leaders, but a knowledge of economics, finance, and investment. No, I think it's the lack of interest in getting better understanding. I mean, it's one thing if you don't care. I get that. But come on, these people aren't average people. They're making policy. And it couldn't come at a worse time. Record debt, monetary crisis, high inflation, record taxes, geopolitical upheaval, and now an energy and food shortage. It's interesting. You've got to note that none of our leaders or climate activists or grandstanding cheerleaders at the COP26 saw this price increase coming, which is incredible because it had already started in Europe 2 months before. They don't show any understanding of the spillover impact on fertilizer costs due to the rise in natural gas. Again, that was readily apparent in September and October with skyrocketing ammonia prices. I'm worried, though, that they don't seem to have learned anything from this. The energy challenge is not difficult to understand, though. I mean, 84% of the world's energy comes from fossil fuels, and the transition to renewable energy is going to take decades. But it's also going to need a massive amount of things like diesel and gas to transition to wind, solar, hydroelectric power, nuclear, and build the infrastructure needed for things like charging stations for electric vehicles. And we still don't have the battery storage technology to solve the intermittent power problems of wind and solar that really showed up in the UK and Europe this past fall, pushing energy prices way up. Now, speaking of nuclear, did you see this? Canada recently announced the Green Bond Framework, focused on raising capital to support the federal government's climate agenda, which inexplicably excludes nuclear power as eligible for funding. I mean, much to the applause of groups like Greenpeace, but think about it. UK, France, China, Argentina, Brazil, Bulgaria, Czech Republic, Egypt, Finland, Hungary, India, Kazakhstan, Poland, Saudi Arabia, Uzbekistan. Hey, they're all commissioning new nuclear plants. But maybe more than that, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change calls for an increase in nuclear power by between 98 and 501% to avoid the most dangerous aspects of climate change. But no, we couldn't get that one past the climate ideologues in Ottawa. Meanwhile, the negative impact of high gas, oil, diesel, coal prices, I think it continues to move up the income ladder. Sure, the poor are already feeling it. But a global Ipsos Reid poll this week found nearly a quarter of Canadians, they can't make ends meet, but another 28% are on the edge. Hey, maybe if you're lucky enough to be able to afford the price increases of energy and food and others, well, don't rest too easy, because I think this isn't over. Your turn may be coming. Hey, just a quick announcement before we get to Sam Cooper. We've got a new feature coming on Money Talks, and it's starting on April 14th. We're going to do it in the evening, 6 p.m. Pacific time. What we're going to do is an hour-long Q&A session. I'm going to be there and try and answer the questions from as many as Inside Edge subscribers as possible in a Zoom webinar approach. I mean, it's going to be free for all our Inside Edge subscribers, but the platform, just a reminder, only allows 500 participants. So when you get your emailed invitation starting on, we're going to send it out, I think, April 2nd, so next week, make sure to register as soon as you can. And by the way, if you're not an Inside Edge subscriber yet, well, there's still lots of time to join. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca and check out all the benefits of the program, including just a recent sample of the exclusive content offered. Hey, stay with me, as I say, Sam Cooper, but I also got a great quote of the week on the truckers' convoy and the vaccine mandates. I think you're going to be surprised by it. More to come. Stay with us. Just a few months ago, I said, if there's one book you must read, it's Willful Blindness, How a Network of Narcos, Tycoons, and CCP Agents Infiltrated the West. Could be infiltrated Canada, too. Well, also, I should say, Sam Cooper is the author of that, Global TV ace reporter. And, you know, I always talk about journalism, and I'm very critical of the media in many ways. But I'll tell you, then you have to remember, you have to be more complete in your assessment, and that is, there are some brilliant people working in the media. And I think of people like Sam Cooper, who's done, I think, us all an incredible service with his years of work into this very subject, how a network of narcos, tycoons, and Communist Party of China agents infiltrated our country and the West. Sam Cooper joins me now. Sam, great time to have you. I've got lots of questions relating to, you know, is it a similar situation with Russia and the oligarchs? Are they hiding their money? But first, I just want to start with this. After years of research, what sort of surprised you most when you came to writing the book, or not came to writing, but as much as here's part of that story and you go, jaw dropper, can't believe it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I'm doing an update chapter for the book that should be coming out in this May. And I think it's appropriate to say that, because my answer is the more I look at this story and how it relates to things going on in the world, I keep being shocked. But I think I can give you, you know, one or two examples. For me, the jaw dropper was, and I explain it in the book, you know, my Canadian educated mind couldn't get around the fact that that one of the most powerful governments in the world, an authoritarian regime, is directly involved with transnational organized crime. And not only that, the evidence is giving directions to high-level gangsters, is using gangsters in espionage operations, is using gangsters to approach our politicians, is using gangsters to harass Canadians that may have immigrated from other countries to get away from authoritarian dictatorships. And people are being harassed by gangsters in Canada that are tasked by the Chinese Communist Party. And why, you know, why can this happen? I mean, the Communist Party trades off, you know, really criminality. They let these criminals profit through cybercrime, drug trafficking, if they return objectives to the party. So in a nutshell, we could talk about that one for a long time. That's what blew my mind and shocked me. But I can also add that I put together puzzle pieces where I could say with confidence and evidence that fentanyl traffickers were some of the biggest gamblers in BC government casinos. Now I can say with absolute certainty and put actual numbers on, the biggest gambler in BC government casinos was a known suspected fentanyl precursor importer, a known suspected casino loan shark, known to be connected to the Chinese government. This was known, and that's I'll unpack those details more in this updated chapter I'm talking about. But I guess I want to say that just the extreme scale of how much money these suspected drug kingpins were laundering through BC casinos, and also the knowledge that people at a high level in BC's government, they knew, or as the lawyers said, should have known, but I think they knew that these were drug traffickers. And not only did they turn a blind eye, but there's certainly, you know, suggestions that a lot more could have been going on than just turning a blind eye to boost government revenue.
And you see the infiltration continue. I mean, there was accusations that had very strong basis in evidence of the Communist Party of China, for example, participating in the last federal election. I mean, that's just one thing that jumps out at me. But it's just so much more, as your book elaborates. Willful blindness talks about immigration fraud, of course, the money laundering. But the fentanyl, I think, would be a surprise. We know the fentanyl problem, but to see its roots coming from there, you know, it's mind-boggling how little reaction or pushback there's been from government.
It is. And you know, we're one thing that has really dawned on me, and I think some others in the past 2 weeks with this horrific tragedy in the Ukraine, is that I think more people could understand that the Russian government was deeply connected to organized crime and using gangsters, turning them into tycoons, using them in intelligence. But people, you know, the People's Republic of China was a lot harder to understand. But now I think people get, you know, that what I call strategic corruption, that is how foreign governments use gangsters and turn them into tycoons and use them to infiltrate other countries. People can see the consequences of that now in Russia. Why is the whole world now lighting its hair on fire, so to speak, to go after these Russian oligarchs? Enough people knew that the oligarchs were very connected to organized crime, but now we've got the moral imperative. People understand that Putin could not be doing what he's doing. He could not be funding his army unless he was using these oligarchs worldwide. So my question, you know, what's really in my mind right now, I grew up idolizing Wayne Gretzky. He was always skating or saying, I'm going to go where the puck is supposed to be. So why have Canadian leaders not been looking at where the puck is going to be with regards to the People's Republic of China and how they use the exact same system as Vladimir Putin does?
And, you know, you look at what's happened in Russia and a lot of the stuff I've been reading, that was also an eye opener for me, is to degree it's sort of like, you can call it a kleptocracy or whatever. But I don't think there's any debate about that. You're talking about an incredibly wealthy person when you talk about Vladimir Putin. And as you say, you look at these oligarchs that are planted around the world with huge influence and buying up companies, et cetera. Again, the light seems to have just gone on a little bit. And I love that comparison. Like, why did we sort of get that Putin was running that kind of a state where reading things like the military was actually secondary to his security state because the security state protected him in his power, along with these oligarchs that he literally made billionaires. And it's fascinating to see that Canadians just still seem naive at what we're dealing with here.
I think so. That's a point without trying to be obnoxious or arrogant. I mean, it's a point I make in my book that, you know, I had a good education in Canada, but I wasn't taught that other countries do not play by the rules that we set for ourselves and that we expect, for example, of our brothers and sisters, as it were, in the United States. You know, we can be pretty hard on our partners south of the border in looking at what they do around the world. But I don't think we're very hard on other countries that play by a lot. You know, they do not pay attention to the rule of law. And so we've already kind of talked about it, but I think it really does take, you know, the tragedy, the visions of hospitals being bombed in the Ukraine for people to understand that other states have no compunction at using any tool.
And how tough is it at this point? And again, it comes back to how the difficulty of the research and the length of time it took you to research willful blindness. But I'm looking even at the Russian situation when you see a collection of shell companies, for example. I can't even imagine how difficult it is to sort of trace where one of these oligarchs' monies are or assets or what have you.
Yeah, no, there are other authors worldwide that have really dug in specifically to the Russian oligarch networks, which use a lot of offshore registrations in you know, the British Isles. Some of those small jurisdictions have a whole industry built around facilitating shell companies. And, you know, it can take years for a well-resourced police department or agency to trace some of these assets. In my case, I mean, ironically, in some ways, Vancouver, for me, it became a little bit easier. For one, because a great source leaked documents that he got in trouble for. He was working with the BC Lottery Corporation, but these documents named some of these the most, you know, the biggest boosters of revenue in BC casinos. And through these leaks, I was able to establish that they were investigated as a part of a transnational fentanyl trafficking gang. And these people were so brazen that they used BC's courts to enforce these gangster casino loan sharking loans and turn them into real estate loans. And so, you know, in some cases, you didn't even have to dig into their family members or go through different straw buyers or as they say, you know, nominee buyers. You could just see this person has a criminal record. He's been accused of fentanyl trafficking. He has turned over to the Vancouver police, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, not fighting the allegations. And he's a real estate lender. He's a big real estate developer. So I could find that in Vancouver, again, thanks to brazen usage or abusage of our courts and leaked documents from a very upright whistleblower.
Can I just an aside for a sec, were you ever worried for your own safety? Because you're taking on there's nobody who has done more on this file, nobody who exposed more on this file to the public, which creates some political pressure. And I'm just wondering, did you ever just sit back and say, man, this is dangerous stuff? Because I would assume it is very dangerous stuff crossing these people. There's that much money involved.
I won't say that I have received, you know, a direct threat where I had to go to the police and say, you know, what should I do? Or a threat of violence? I want to be a little bit careful because I have got information that let's just say it didn't settle my mind. So yeah. There were certainly times where, and I've had counsel from people that are allowed to carry around guns because they're in the government. And I've had good advice. And yes, they've said the people you're writing about are very dangerous. The people you're writing about have connections to the Chinese government. I've had confirmations that the Chinese government is taking some interest in me. I'll leave it at that, but that will come up in this update chapter. So in a nutshell, I want to say that I do take precautions and I am very careful. And I'm aware of warnings that I've had, but I want to add that, again, another hero, the Vancouver Sun reporter, Kim Bolin, I know that she has gotten, you know, some very direct and scary warnings, and she heroically does what she does. I learned from her, but I have never had a threat as direct as Kim has.
She does do fabulous work. I've had the pleasure of meeting Kim and her work has been tremendous. Let me just come back. And in the book, you describe sort of the Vancouver model, I would call it. Is that correct? You know, I mean, that's my, you know, the Vancouver model. Just give us, I'm sort of embarrassed about asking you to summarize years of work. And can you give it to me in 10 seconds? It's like I've been invaded by the spirit of Barbara Walters here. But give me the idea of, just to give people a sense of how they accomplished it, how they do the money laundering.
Sure. If you give me 15 to 20, I can do it. So the key factor here is in China, they have a capital export barrier of $50,000 per year per citizen. As we know, a tremendous amount of wealth created in that communist nation. A lot of people trying to get out around that $50,000 barrier. They can't do it above ground. So they have to find gray, black, or illegal, if you want to say, ways. How they do it? They meet a loan shark in a Macau casino, and they arrange a contract where I'm going to fly to Vancouver. You're going to give me, I want to gamble, let's say $500,000. And so they travel to Richmond's airport. They meet the gangster in a parking lot. He gives them a bag with $500,000. They gamble and they can pay. So that's a debt. Obviously, that's a debt, but they can pay it back in China, where they have, of course, their bank account, and the drug trafficker has his bank account. So they can very easily transfer that debt back to the gangster in China without appearing on any radar. And I'll add one more piece. When you have money to burn, let's say you're a drug trafficker with 30 million, you want to get out around the world to Australia, maybe Canada, let's say even a bit to Las Vegas. You don't care if you're losing night after night. You're going to win some of those nights, and you walk out of the BC government casino with a $1 million check. Of course, you've got a down payment on one of those nice condos in downtown Vancouver.
That's the side, of course, grab so many people's attention, is to what degree this has influenced the luxury real estate side of things.
And my answer is, I believe we've had studies that suggest a massive amount, but only moved prices 5%. That was an official BC study. And I just believe that it's much bigger than that. It's bigger than we know. In my update chapter, I have evidence now that it's not just these underground cash transactions or hockey bags of cash going into casinos. There's actually, you know, interconnected underground banks worldwide that are infiltrating our big five Canadian banks through shell companies that wire money in from Hong Kong and very easily get that directly into Canadian bank accounts. So that is just flooding into Vancouver real estate. I'll leave you with one more data point. Years ago, I was told from very credible sources in the industry, 30 cents of every dollar in Vancouver real estate comes directly from mainland China, or perhaps it passes through Hong Kong as well. So that's a lot of money that isn't passing through legitimate channels, pumping into the market. That's why I say it's not all straight drug money laundering, but a lot of it passes through illicit or underground banks. So it has to have a huge price impact.
And let's close off with this. And I'm not going to close off with this. I'm going to say, you've got a new chapter coming out. You're saying it's in May, of willful blindness. And again, I want to tell people, boy, you care about our country. I can't think of a more important book that I've come across in a great number of years. This is something that we have suspected. We've been warned about it by CSIS. We've been warned by the Canadian military. And it just doesn't feel like we've done too much about it. Are you hopeful going forward that finally, with you shining the light on this phenomenal issue, you know, I mean, we've talked about immigration fraud. We've talked about fentanyl, you know, the casino money laundering, the story that you broke there. The list is a long one of things that made the news. Are we making the connection, and do you see the demand sort of to actually finally do something about it? They're in our politics, they're in our boardrooms, they're in our academics, some of this money. So I just find it just a head shaker that more hasn't been done.
Yeah, I mean, I have two minds on it. For one, we have those Cullen Commission final reports and recommendations coming out, should be May. So I believe there could be some very serious recommendations. I also believe that Justice Cullen understands the issues. So we'll see what he recommends, and we'll see how the government responds to that. I've been told by people in the Conservative Party, they want whatever recommendations come out of the commission applied across Canada. So if we see some great recommendations and the political will is there, you know, there could be great changes. The other thought on my mind, again, is a little bit tragic, and well, it's mixed. Again, we see a tremendous wave of political will in going after gang-connected Russian oligarchs now. We've got a U.S. transnational-led task force. Canada will be part of that, right? We've got almost a mania of tracking these golden yachts around the world. So things can change, but does it have to be a war that changes them? That's what I want to put to morally to the leaders of Canada now. Do we have to wait until Taiwan is invaded? Because that could happen. We know it could happen until people look very seriously at the Communist Party's ends around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so with you on that. But I sort of say, is the Taiwan invasion an if or a when? I think Xi Jinping has said it's a when. You know, it's coming. And we were so ill-prepared for what's happened in Ukraine. We didn't, you know, despite, I must be fair, the intelligence from the U.S. was good, Afghanistan bad, Ukraine good. I mean, this is all on the table. We've had the warnings, and I hope we have the leadership. But in the meantime, I got to congratulate you again on the book. I look forward to your updated version, Willful Blindness. Don't wait for that, though. Go out and get a copy. Sam Cooper, brilliant work. Thank you.
Thanks so much. This has been great.
Time now for the quote of the week. But first, a little personal context. See, I believe in open discussion, inviting questions. I mean, the Prime Minister himself stated a couple of weeks ago, in quotes, diversity of ideas helps us learn from one another. Talking with people who think differently from us is how we challenge ourselves. Challenging ourselves is how we grow. Well, I agree with him, although I've got to say, I don't see much evidence to suggest the Prime Minister's willingness to put that in practice, at least when it comes to the government agenda, especially with issues like how to tackle climate change or COVID. And unfortunately, you know, still my criticism of media is, I think, way too many go along with that. I mean, the lack of debate and open discussion around COVID policies and guidelines has been, I think, the chief characteristic of COVID coverage in Canada. And I think it's actually undermined public confidence in both government and the media, although I know I want to acknowledge that many people would disagree with that. But it's the context for my quote of the week. I mean, vaccine mandates have got to be on everyone's short list for the most divisive policies in generations. See, at first, I mean, both the Prime Minister and health officers came out strongly against vaccine mandates. But you know what? When we got into the spring, late spring of 2021, polls suggested that it might be a very successful wedge issue as we went to that September election. Well, the government decided to implement them and demonize anyone who opposed them. And sadly, again, much of the media went along with it. As Blacklock's reporter, by the way, who continues to do excellent investigative work, they note in testimony this week in front of the Commons Health Committee, the head of the Ontario Association of Radiologists, Dr. David Jacobs, stated that the mandate was, in quotes, politically driven. It did not help anyone in the healthcare industry. It did not convince anyone to change their mind, end of quote. He went on to state that the Prime Minister's vilification of those who oppose the mandates, you know, he called them racist, misogynist, a fringe group, in quotes, was uniquely unhelpful. Now, in her testimony before the Commons Health Committee this week, Dr. Sherry Kalin, professor of medicine, University of British Columbia, said in quotes, "It's clear, especially with Omicron, the vaccines we have cannot really be relied upon to either prevent transmission or infection. As an example, the first Omicron case in Israel came from a triple vaccinated doctor returning from a conference who passed it on to another triple vaccinated physician. With this evidence, we should have moved quickly to lift the heavy-handed measures and explain the evolving evidence. This is necessary for public trust. It's also good for public health to have a well-informed populace. Having a false sense of security has obviously negative consequences," end of quote. I love to get the chance of talking to people within the industry, and I'm talking, of course, about copper, about gold, about other, you know, other minerals, etc. Mark Brown is president of Pacific Opportunities Capital, and they kind of do it all. They're a one-stop shop in terms of they help raise capital, but they give the financial advice. Mark's background is he's got the CA designation, and I know that from my own experience that a lot of people who sort of get in to various industries, in this case, we're going to be talking about, mining, they need some of the business acumen too. And that's what Pacific Opportunities also provides. Mark, appreciate you finding time for us.
That's great to be here, Michael. Happy to offer some insights here.
Well, let's start with the one that, I mean, is hardly a surprise. People wondering about the impact of the Russian invasion in Ukraine, the sanctions. I mean, that's still evolving where that's going to go. Is it going to be escalated? Is it going to find some sort of agreement to at least subside, the hostility. So I just want to, what do you do when you look at a big geopolitical event like that?
So these are the black swan events that we totally look for. But having said that, I mean, just looking at the supply and demand for these metals, it takes a long time to build a mine right now. And all these metals are in demands for new technologies, copper in particular, a third of the world doesn't have electricity and they want electricity. So the demand is very steady and very much growing. New technologies are increasing that. And then you come along, so it takes a long time to build a mine, to find an economic deposit. And then you come along and you have this event like the invasion of the Ukraine. And that just throws a wrench into everything. And it's going to make these prices for these metals go up because even if the war gets stopped, for a long time, these supply lines are going to be in trouble. I see Russia doing a lot of deals with China coming up, so that'll change things a little bit. I don't know exactly where that's going to go, but the rest of the world's going to be scrambling to get supply, and we've got a lot of work to do to keep those supply lines moving.
And one of the themes we've had on Money Talks for since really the summer of 2019, but into 2020, was, look, if we're going to do this transition thing, to renewable energy, we are really short the essential metals. But your point there, so obviously we need copper. I know you're involved with copper, but the point you're also making is this is not stuff you just switch on a light switch. Oh, presto, I need more copper. These mines, especially in the kind of regulatory environment we are in the West, and maybe some people are a little nervous about the regulatory, the government involvement in other jurisdictions, they take time. I mean, you can't just sort of snap your fingers. And so, as you say, it's sort of a guarantee of demand as we go forward, if indeed we are going to transition.
That's exactly right. I mean, just to give you an idea, even just finding an economic deposit can take 5 to 10 years. And then you need a lot of drilling to see the size of it and the grade and understand how you would process it. And even once you get there, the environmental rules, which are very well established in Canada and the U.S., and easy to follow, make things take longer because you do a lot of baseline testing for your environment to make sure that everything's maintained the way it should be. And these processes just take, they always have taken a lot of time. And remember that these resources, the mining companies, when you find a deposit, it's a finite resource. It's a deposit that has limits on its size, and it's going to be, 15 to 20 years, and it's mined out and gone. So you need to find new ones. And that's where these junior exploration companies really are the experts to do that.
You find it's an environment, just in saying that it may be better or more advantageous to actually buy one who's already in the business, who's already doing the exploration, probably has some proven reserves. It would seem to me that this would encourage sort of some merger acquisition kind of opportunities there instead of starting from just dead scratch.
Well, that's exactly right. And the major companies do some exploration, but a lot of it is left to these junior companies. And I really like getting involved. So we invest in the clients that we work with. We're usually a major shareholder of them. And I really like getting involved with companies that have some high-grade drill holes, high-grade drill results of whatever element it is they're looking for, or companies that are near historic mines, or maybe even that have a historic resource on the ground. Because that, once you get into that discovery mode and start to build that, and then maybe you get into a deposit and calculate it or estimate a resource, then that's where the big companies are going to start to pay attention and start to come calling and potentially buy out your junior resource company.
When you're, as you say, you get to choose who you work with. I mean, you could be hired also just strictly on a consulting basis, but when you put your company's money involved also to help finance, can you just give me like the two or three main criteria? Because obviously that's at a bigger scale than most of us invest at, but some of the same rules apply.
That's right. And we have a very specific rule. So I have two partners who are also CAs. I'm ex-Pricewaterhouse, they're ex-Deloitte's. And one of the key things for us is to work with really good people. We can change out the projects. We can change out the company or reset the company. But you got to have people that are well-driven and who know what they're doing, who've hopefully made discoveries before. After that, we look at projects and the elements and the jurisdictions. And because we're a smaller group and we get so many opportunities, we really focus on ones that we really like and think we can help add value to those companies by bringing them good financial oversight.
Tell me about the time frame, by the way. Again, I'm looking at individual investors being able to piggyback on what you've learned. What's a realistic time frame? Obviously, somebody comes knocking on your door and says, hey, I'll buy that whole project. I'll buy that company. That's a different deal. But, you know, just I just don't, you know, people impatient doesn't really work.
No, it doesn't. And I'll tell you one story. I mean, there was a company we started in 1999. That by 2012, after supporting that company for 13 years, was a $500 million market cap company. And through that whole process, we backed the people. We had to change out the CEO a couple of times, but we liked the project and we kept going with it. And eventually that was a rare earth element company. And eventually the share price skyrocketed and we were the largest shareholder. And then everyone came to us and said, how did you get so many shares? And I'm like, well, I've been buying this for 10 years and supporting it and backing it. And that's too long for most investors. But all the way along, they were achieving their milestones and the project was getting better and better. The grade was coming out good. And so that's the kind of thing we like to see is successful programs, one after another, that continue on. And eventually they get bigger and bigger until you get some major that comes along that really wants to take them out because they're the ones, they're the expert at putting those into production.
Sorry, I'm just going to throw a little curveball at you for a second because I'm going to ask you what you're thinking of the copper market and the silver market because you're involved directly, gold market, et cetera. But first, you know, I've been chronicling with Victor Adair, I mean, this incredible mess on the London Metals Exchange, you know, with obviously not being able to get an official price for almost 2 weeks for nickel, you know, the stop and start 1 week, not. What does that do to things? Or are you just thinking, okay, well, that's a short-term deal. There's nothing really much for us here because we're longer term.
So nickel is used in lots of stuff that people don't know behind the scenes, but one of the popular ones right now is nickel metal hydride batteries. The hydride metal they talk about there is rare earth elements, but you need a lot of nickel in those batteries, and that's for electric cars, and that's an alternative to the lithium batteries as well. And I always believe you need a few different alternative technologies to work, but with the nickel market, you've got Norilsk, the Russian company that's one of the biggest suppliers. And they have mines all over the world, but their Russian supply is now basically stopping or they're not allowed to export. Or I don't know exactly what's going to happen there, but that is owned by Roman Abramovich, and he's been sanctioned. And so that's a big game changer for that market. And I think the nickel market will settle down a bit, but do I think it's going to go back to where the prices were? No, I think they're going to remain very high. And again, it's hard to find nickel deposits. We actually have one company drilling for nickel in Quebec. And that's early stage. If that company actually hits something, they have a good chance of hitting something. But if they do, it's, you know, you're 10 to 15 years before you can actually produce any nickel. And that's what people just don't understand how long it takes. And the grades of these deposits are also going lower and lower. And that's a problem because you're going to mine more and actually recover less. And so it's harder and harder to find these things, particularly with copper. So copper, people used to look at 1% as a grade for a deposit. And now you're looking at things 0.35, 0.33% copper. And those are big ones, those lower grade ones. But still, that's a lot of technology to get that much copper out of a ton of rock.
And you're bringing another great point that I think is people aren't as aware of as they should be. And that is you do get different grades, you know, number one. So it's not just sort of nickel. if you know what I mean. There's, you know, are you getting the right stuff, the right grades, that kind of thing. Let me go further with copper, because that's one of the things that was a big recommendation on Money Talks in February 2020. We were big on commodities, but, and again, it was sort of simplistic or straightforward on my part. It was, you know what, if you really want to do electric vehicles, and I believe the governments did and the public did, you really want to do renewable energy, we're not even in the ballpark for the amount of copper we need. And I appreciated what you were just saying. And it's not as easy to get, you know, at a high grade as it used to be. So what are you thinking of the copper market going forward? And again, I'm not asking next Tuesday, but, you know, 3-5 years out, the way you do an investment.
Well, the copper market is interesting because, as you probably have said before in your show, I'm sure they call copper Dr. Copper because it's a great proxy for the whole economy. And copper prices they've jumped up and they're steadily going higher. They're trading well. And you've got all sorts of problems on the supply. It's hard to find copper deposits worldwide. It's hard to get them in production. And quite often you get governments in regions where copper is heavily used, like Peru and Chile right now. The governments are a bit of a mess. And people don't know what they're happening. So what that means is there's even less investment in those areas to find more copper deposits. So again, you know, if you've got a copper market that's worth, it's much more than this, but say it was $1 billion and demand went down 1%, well, the price is going to go down a bunch. But what's happening now is the demand's going up 2, 3, 4, 5% with all these new technologies. And it takes what's already a very large market and it really pushes that price higher. So it's a big market. So steadily, I think it's going to continue to go up. That's going to lead to even more inflation in our whole economy because it affects so many things we do that people don't even realize. I mean, recently during COVID, copper is biostatic. Bacteria doesn't grow on copper. So people started putting copper back on doorknobs and stuff like that to help stop the spread of disease. It's just a property that it has. It's interesting. It's a very small use for it. But there's another use of copper while people were trying to avoid COVID. So there's lots of things, but I see nothing but good demand for copper coming up.
The other side that, you know, I know I've kept you longer than I said, but the other side is both gold and silver. I'm kind of interested in personally, you know, I mean, I'm looking at a monetary crisis. That's my thesis, you know, declining value of, fiat currencies. The papers aren't buying as much. So how do you protect yourself? So I kind of have been talking about the gold and silver market. I'm patient with it. So let me start with silver. Just you know, you can give me other. I mean, there's industrial uses, of course, that come into play here too.
Yeah, and silver is also used very quietly behind the scenes in lots of different technologies coming up. But what people don't know on the supply side is that silver is often produced as a byproduct from other mines. So there's very few primary silver mines. So it's hard to find a high-grade silver deposit. And when those mines run out of their primary ore, they're going to stop producing that silver as well. So it's got the potential in that market to actually explode. And that's why you get a lot of these crazy kind of silver bugs that say this is going to go crazy. And it does from time to time. It's happened in the past in the history, and it could easily happen again soon.
What about the gold side? That's, of course, people looking to protect themselves. You know, I think it's a bit erroneous with inflation because we've got lots of incidences where inflation goes up and gold doesn't. But we have 100% when people lose confidence in the currency, gold responds. And of course, I know we're talking about real interest rates too and all of that, but give me your snapshot on gold.
Well, I'm a coin collector, Michael, and I'll tell you, people buying physical gold through coins, through auctions that I participate in Vancouver, often are paying way higher than what you see the quoted gold price. So the financial markets are one thing and all the paper contracts in the market are one thing, but the physical gold trade is at probably a 20 to 30% premium. And I think the price of gold that's quoted is going to catch up to that pretty soon.
And one last thing, because I know that, you know, you're chairman of Alianza Minerals, you know, Avirupa Minerals, it's in Europe. Geopolitical risk, I think that's on the front burner now. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't want to be investing in Russia and, you know, having been caught in that. I think people are having a second look at China or a third look. So it seems to me where your projects are, you're sort of at least eliminating a lot of that geopolitical risk, or at least what we anticipate at this moment.
That's exactly right. It's hard enough to find a deposit. So you don't want to find a deposit somewhere where you're never going to be able to mine it. You need to look in areas where there's good mining history, good mining expertise, and a good infrastructure for the environmental rules and a mining way of owning claims that is secure so that you don't lose out those to governments or whatever. So it's really important to be in good jurisdictions, and that's we really focus on that.
I was waiting to end with this question, and that's give me a grade for Canada. As you just think broadly speaking, I want to do some exploration and develop and put a mine in whatever the substance, you know, coming out of the mineral coming out of it. How would you grade Canada as in terms of, hey, that's a really attractive place to be, or, oh my gosh, they make it tough?
It's a bit of a mix, and it's a bit of a mix by province or territory. Some of the Northern Territories are quite good. They have very strict rules, but you can work within those rules when you know that they are. Quebec's very favorable because they still have a good attitude of mining there, and they actually help fund it a lot. British Columbia, you really need to know where you are specifically within the province. Some of the First Nations groups are fantastic to work with. Other ones aren't as advanced yet, and they're thinking about mining or whether they want mines in their areas. So you really have to know specifically. And of course, in our companies, we use consultants to help guide us. And we regularly meet with the communities, make sure that the groups we're working with are often actually working with us as partners on projects. So that's really important. So it's a very specific question. Canada itself is generally a very good place because we have so much expertise and financing expertise. But there's issues in specific areas you got to be careful of.
That was a very good answer, by the way. Mark, thank you for finding time for us. President of Pacific Opportunities Capital. He's also chairman of Alianza Minerals, Avirupa Minerals in Europe. But great to be able to pick your brain here and talk about the big and the small and get down to the details of what it's like on the ground. Mark, thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
I want to bring Mike Levy in right now. You know, Mike, one of the things you and I have been chronicling is the increase in crisis across the board, of course, and the worry that, of course, it doesn't just impact lower income Canadians, but that impact is sort of rising up the income scale. Why? Because you continue to do it. You've got high food prices, but the big one still seems to be high energy prices. And as I alluded to in my editorial, interesting to see the about face of so many politicians when it came to climate change and all of a sudden subsidizing people using, you know, gasoline, et cetera. And Canada looks like it's wading in on that.
Well, Mike, the energy minister announced this week that Canada plans to hike oil exports to help ease the global energy crunch. And the fact is, energy firms in Alberta have said that production could be increased in the near term by another 200,000 to 400,000 barrels a day. But guess what? They can't ship it across the country because there's no way to do that in Canada. But they've got the path to ship it down to the Gulf Coast in the United States. So it will help somewhat to ease some of the shortage. But Canada's on record now to saying we can pump more. Well, gosh, as you said, what an about face.
Well, it's interesting, of course. As soon as we saw Joe Biden go hack cap in hand to Venezuela, to Saudi Arabia, say, can you increase your production or please increase your production? I mean, how couldn't we respond? Well, why did you kill the Keystone Pipeline? Why are you going to Venezuela, for goodness sakes, or Saudi Arabia?
Well, and the fact is the International Energy Agency Ministers Conference in Paris just acceded to increased energy production to replace Russian oil and gas, and Canada is an integral part of that group. And meanwhile, by the way, I just wanted to put this by the way, while they're talking about that, Trudeau's meeting in another part of Europe and talking about green transition of LNG and oil. And he completely stayed away from any announcement of increasing Canadian oil production, but that hasn't stopped the minister. That hasn't stopped the energy companies. And if we can get infrastructure built, we, Canada, can be the solution. But we have had to get the energy policy right. And the energy policy can't only be about climate change. It has to be about energy security, reliability, and affordability, too.
Yeah, I'll be fascinated to see in this tug of war between ideology and practicality. Mike, thanks for the time. Time now for the shocking stat of the week. Oil prices have dominated the news. Come on, it's the price of filling up our car, heating our home, taking a ferry with the fuel surcharge or a plane with a surcharge. Well, they've all gone up. And of course, the price of virtually every good that's transported has had to reflect those cost increases, which is, I'm sure, I mean, we all know by now, the result of supply not being able to meet demand. Well, some may debate it, but I think it's a fair statement to say our discussions regarding energy have been less than realistic and practical. So for today's shocking stat, all I want to do is bring to your attention a couple of facts that should form the context of our discussions, regardless of your opinion. I mean, first, for those who think that it's all about the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions, no. Consider that at the end of January, OECD inventories were at eight-year lows. What's also very clear to me, at least, is the amount of new oil production seems to be misunderstood and appreciated. We need to bring on new oil production just to replace the current decline of reserves, not meet new demand as the economy grows. I mean, it's simply how much new oil has to come online to maintain the status quo. Now, that's a big picture item, and it's difficult to measure. I mean, the industry needs to bring on, though, if you look at some of the reports, about 3 million new barrels per day. But I want to put that in perspective. That's like we have to replace the equivalent of the entire production of the North Sea oil every year. I mean, with costs something like $600 billion. Now, by the way, many people estimate that the amount needed to maintain just today's level is going to actually be higher, even more costly. And of course, that depends on where you're getting the increased production from. But the point is that it's not widely appreciated that we need significant new production just to maintain the status quo, let alone any increase in demand as we get to pre-COVID levels again or beyond. You've got also emerging nations which are developing that have increased demand. So to say no more oil production, as many do, is unrealistic. Without a huge jump in prices and reduction in our standard of living, as long as we don't have a realistic replacement power grid. One of the big themes on Money Talks, and I'm proud to say I can go back to the Outlook conference in February 2020. Think about that. And at that conference, I made a very clear statement that we would get one more kick at the can with low rates. It would go down. My prediction at that point was into the summer of 2020. And by the way, that was made before the pandemic. It was based on some other modeling. But we'd get one more kick at the can. And then once it would start to go up, look out. Well, that's the environment I think we find ourselves now. And that's why I wanted to get Ozzy Jurek in here from ozbuzz.ca and talk about the mortgage market. Because, of course, the mortgage market is set by more influence, let's say, by the five-year bond rate. Nothing to do with the Bank of Canada's overnight rate. I shouldn't say nothing, but the big influences are what people are willing to lend money at in the bond market. Ozzy Jurek joins me now. Ozzy, first of all, just set out for me, what's been going on in the mortgage market?
Well, the crazy thing is when you go to the United States, we've seen a huge increase in rates. I mean, it's actually up 44% in 2 months from about 2.7% to 4.83% to their 30-year rate. Now, we don't have a 30-year rate in Canada, but this is their 30-year rate, sort of a benchmark. Now, the high in that rate in the United States was, of course, in 1981, when, like in Canada, we had a 16.5% rate. But really, since 2010, the United States had about a 4.7% rate. And you know, just like you just pointed out, the big reason for the rate to go up from 2013 on was that the bond market panicked a little bit when the Federal Reserve said it would stop buying as many bonds. So we sort of, it's almost like an instant replay. But since about 2016, the average rate was about 3.6%. And then so we fluctuated in that range where we came down through the pandemic to just a 2.5 to 2.7% rate in the United States. Well, not anymore. We're now closer to 5%.
But let's talk about Canada also. So that's a U.S. 30-year rate. But I've also noticed, of course, that Canadian mortgage rates have been going up too, in reflection again of the bond market moves.
Yeah, it's kind of, I talked to Kyle Green, who is one of my mortgage brokers of choice, and he says, you know, it's kind of, it's about 3.7% now for a five-year term. And if you look closer, the CIBC rate now is 3.42, so it's lower, but Scotiabank is 4.99. So clearly, as a buyer of a long-term mortgage, you really got to watch which bank you're dealing with, and because the difference is astounding. What is really the key here, Mike, though, is that at 3.75, we did have five-year terms as low as 2.6. So while the 0.25% increase on the overnight rate resulted already in the expectation and reality of a 1% higher rate in the longer term.
You know, it's funny, I was getting asked, as you were, I'm sure, over the last couple of years, should I lock in my variable? I'm sort of just smiling because my response was, if they get asked that today, I said, yeah, nearly 2 years ago you should have, or 18 months ago you should have. I mean, it's a tough question to know where interest rates are going. You've hit on the key component, though. The central banks have said at this moment, I'm not going into support. I will keep up my level of government bonds, but I'm not going to add to it. Both Canada and the U.S. are there. And it's, of course, the central bank action when they stepped in, starting in September of 2019, they stepped in, bought the bonds in order to keep rates low. And now, as I say, they're not doing that. They're maintaining, they do buy bonds still from the government, but they're just to maintain the level that they already own. So this is what the market's responding to. It's always an impossible question. Should you lock in or not? I think it just comes back to individual risk. You know, I'm one of those guys, Aussie, who doesn't like to speculate on interest rates through my house. I'll do it other ways. You know, I can bet on an ETF. I can go into the futures market. I'm just saying with my house, I'm always a lot more conservative.
Well, that's true. On your house, of course, if you're going to stay there and you know you're going to stay there, then go long. But if you're not sure and you might have to sell, remember the penalties on a fixed rate are outlandish almost. I mean, we're talking 5 to 10 times as much as a penalty would be on a variable rate, because the variable rate is only 3 months. It's fixed at 3 months, can't be any higher, whereas on the long-term rates, it's different. Just a very quick point. In the United States, the new rates have stopped all mortgage refinancing. So in other words, the huge mortgage refinancing market in the United States is almost dead. People don't want to renew at 4.83%. Secondly, the home builder stocks have crashed, literally crashed, primarily because they're building fewer homes and the market expects that to continue. So while we still have high prices in the States, the market is about to change, and that's the big question about Canada.
Well, of course, we've been saying really from the get-go, absolutely from that sort of spring of 2020, that the biggest variable were interest rates, you know, that they record lows, made it more affordable, made it very competitive with rent. Why am I paying rent when I can own a house, you know, at the same sort of monthly payment? So we saw a lot of that. And I think your point's a very good one, that you're starting to see the impact. People are not going to refinance and pay a penalty for sure. And I want to come back to that penalty thing because I don't want to gloss that over. You know, it's really easy for me to say you should lock in, but not if you think you might not be in that house, because what are you going to do at that point? And I think you make a wonderful point there. And these are some of the variables that individuals have to juggle in making that decision. It's not a one variable sort of either or.
Well, that's right. And also people have to realize, if you just study inflation, you realize that when inflation starts going vertical, which it does now, I mean, 7.9% in the US, over 5% admitted to in Canada, I think much higher. And then when the central banks come in sort of removing the punch bowl too late, the rate hike cycle lasts longer and go higher because people think currently the variable rate is so much lower. Well, that can easily go higher for 2 years in a row, because just because we're at 5% doesn't mean we're going to get back to 2% instantly because we had six small raises at 0.25%. It is probably, in order to get back to the Bank of Canada rate of about 2.5% year over year, it might take three or four years of increases in the variable rates as well as the long-term rates.
And let me just try and confuse everyone listening today, Aussie, and say this, is that the perception of inflation is the key component to bond rates. And the reason is, if I think inflation is going to maintain at that 5 or 6% level, I am not going to lend money to the government by buying a bond at even 4%. You know, and that's what we're looking at. Even if we got 4 rate increases or 7, as the Federal Reserve is saying, that still doesn't come close. And just, sorry, one other thing. We have a 5.7% national rate. The States is quoting at 7.9. The difference is this: we measure it differently. you know, we could get up there too. So I sort of smile. And that's why I continue to come back to, well, I just look at what my food's doing, my rent's doing. You did a great job with rent last week. People should go back and listen to that. You know, and of course, what my energy, my transportation costs are. And that's what the key components are. You know, they call it core. Well, that's my core, that's for sure. I can't avoid those. And it's a lot higher than 5.7%, as everyone has filled up a gas tank knows.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, you know, we're based on economics, Mike, and you realize, did you ever think about that if you rearrange the letters in economics, you get comic nose?
And that may be appropriate for Money Talk. So, Ozzy, thanks for your time. People go to ozbuzz.ca. ozbuzz.ca, or you can stay with me for some comic nose, because I've still got Victor Adair coming up in a Goofy. I want to go live to the trading desk now and bring in Victor Adair again. These markets are so active, but if I think of like two things that really impact our lives in a world that's awash with threat, I got to go to interest rates. We've seen the energy markets. Vic, I mean, I'm watching, and I did allude to it with the Aussie earlier. He's been watching the mortgage rates, but man, interest rates have got to be the star of the show this week.
Well, sure. Driving the mortgage market is the bond market, and both in Canada and in the United States, and by the way, also in Germany, we've got 10-year yields rising like a rocket here. I think right now, the yield on the Canada and the U.S. 10-year in each country got above 2.5%. Okay, for the United States, that's about a 3 or a 4 year high. That is a 8 year high in Canada. That's a big move. And it's not just the bond market. In fact, it's even maybe more extreme in the short term rate market, where, like we call it, 90 day money. The market's future expectation has risen well over a percentage point here since the beginning of March. Right now, the market is pricing 3 month money come December of this year at 3%. That's how quickly this market's been rising.
Gotta forgive me, but I'm proud of the fact here on Money Talks that we have been warning clearly about this event. You know, in February 2020, I basically finished the World Outlook Conference by saying there was one more kick at the can. Rates were going to go down into the summer, maybe into the fall. But once that was done, you do not want to be a borrower at flexible rates. You want it to be fixed rate, because exactly what you've described, Vic, we were looking for sharp moves in the market. And yes, it'll be fluctuations going forward here, up and down, but the overall bias is up. We had a 5,000-year low in interest rates. I think people are going to be in real trouble here. Some people who've been overextended. This is not good news.
Well, you know, you hit on something right there, and we can go to why. Are interest rates rising the way they are? Why are they rising so fast? And like some of the inside the market scuttlebutt, we've had Kevin Muir on the show a number of times. He wrote a column this week pointing out that in the euro dollar futures pit in Chicago, there has been somebody big, like huge, that has been hitting every bid in the euro dollar market, like thousands of contracts at a time, really pushing this market down. So like the talk on the street, and this is just one reason, but the talk on the street is there's somebody big who is positioned wrong here. In other words, rising interest rates are hurting them, and they're trying to hedge their risk by going in and selling the euro dollar market. And of course, the boys on the street, when they smell blood in the water like this, you know, then they start trying to front run that guy, and it really moves the market up quickly. That's one of the rationales as to why the move is so fast.
I think on the shorter term, I'd also be concerned that the psychology about interest rates, about inflation is front and center too. And it works this way, is that people, you know, this is what the central banks did not want to happen. They did not want people to start accepting that inflation was here longer than they had thought. They talked that short-term transitory game right up until December of this year, because why the heck would I lend the government money at 2% as an example, what if I think inflation's running at 7? I mean, it's in a monstrous gap there, and that's why all the talk about they've got to raise rates in order to fight inflation. And I just wonder if some of that isn't coming into the bond market. I still don't know why anybody would hold those kind of rates, you know, even at 3%, Vic. I just don't see inflation dropping back down that far without a major recession. And so this is the game that's going on, and it's started to reflect, as you say, this week and in the last couple of weeks. Man, the move has been quick.
Well, it's kind of like, to use the cliched expression, it's a perfect storm. There's a number of things happening here at the same time. You talk about, rising costs. We've seen energy costs have gone up. Everybody knows that food costs are rising. I mean, I've been reading some real Malthusian pieces here, like about the end of the world because, food costs are going up so fast. But then we have the government. And Governor Newsom down in California is a great example. He's talking about they're going to start issuing checks. And I'm telling you, this is going to happen, where the government's going to say, well, we're going to help the people to live with the rising costs. And we're going to give them checks so that they can more easily fill up their car and buy the groceries and so on. I mean, who would say no to that, except that in the old days, well, we used to talk about when prices were going higher that the best cure for higher prices was higher prices because it caused demand destruction. And I don't know if this is a time for a political rant, but you have to ask yourself in our democratic countries that we have these days and the way they're politically positioned, is demand destruction politically viable anymore? Will they let it happen? Or will they actually, this is so ironic, try to fight inflation with inflation?
Well, a couple of things. One of the things we've been talking about for months was that the Federal Reserve is going to be stuck. Inflation is a huge issue, the number one issue in Canada, but the States has an election coming up in November. That's the midterms. Democrats will lose if this inflation thing, at least if they're not perceived to be fighting inflation, that puts on the Fed's table. But think about this, Vic, when you say fighting inflation with inflation. People, subsidizing, as I was talking about right up front, but subsidizing fossil fuel use, but sending out checks. I mean, my goodness gracious. I mean, you got the US, Germany, UK, Italy, Netherlands, Australia, or rather Austria, Japan, South Korea, France. Should I keep going? All of them doing subsidies, checks, tax breaks. All of that is actually inflationary in an inflationary environment. I don't see that mentioned near enough.
Well, when they let the genie out of the bottle with the stimmy checks, as they call them, to help people deal with having to stay home because of COVID, and government found out how well that worked, both in terms of getting reelected, and keeping the economy going, I think we opened, the Pandora's box or whatever. Anyway, from a trading point of view, what I try to do is position for what I think is going to happen, as opposed to what I think ought to or should happen. And what I see in front of me here is we've just got a lot of pressure on the interest rate market, and that is going to ripple into everything. I mean, when people are calculating how much the stock market should be trading at, one of the key fact functions in that calculation is relative to interest rates. So if interest rates are going higher, then, and here's another thing too, of course, there's been a big sales pitch to have people have a balanced portfolio where they've got 40% of their money in bonds and 60% in stocks. Well, of course, stocks have been off this year, but the bond market's getting killed. So a lot of people that have got that kind of a portfolio, it's underwater year to date, and that's going to have ramifications. Rising interest rates is going to affect every market and everybody in some way.
Well put. That's exactly the point. It impacts everybody in a world where you have record sovereign debt, individual debt. The list goes on. Canadians have $1.86 in debt for every dollar of disposable income. The saving graces, we've got asset prices have gone up even further, their house, et cetera. But still, when you start getting this bump in interest rates, people better take notice. And as you've said, Vic, it was a very sharp rise. Vic, thanks for taking the time. And I know you're going to put more of this up on your trading desk notes at victoradair.ca, victoradair.ca. Wow, lots happening here. We still got a goofy for you. Stay with us. Hey, just before I get to the goofy award, let me start with a free goofy. And it goes to all the people who say, hey, I don't like it when you talk politics. I think that's fair enough. As long as you acknowledge, that's the same thing as saying, don't talk economics and finance or investments. I mean, what do you think is driving commodity prices, if not the direct action of government, or high house prices, which are a direct result of record low interest rates, government, and government's increasing immigration number, that's a demand side, and municipal government zoning regulations and licensing timetable, as well as the myriad of levies and taxes, or inflation. I guess we can't talk about that, because that's driven by the massive increase in money supply because of pandemic policies that actually sent tens of billions of dollars to people who were not impacted financially by the pandemic, far more than they sent to people who were. I mean, that list goes on. The point is, with an ever-intrusive government, you really can't talk about economics, finance, and investment without talking about government. So decide what you're interested in. The trends that are impacting you, your children, your grandchildren financially, their well-being, or would you rather political BS and drama? And if that's what you prefer, well, good luck to you, but you've come to the wrong place. This podcast for grown-ups of all ages. Now to the Goofy Award, actually two. Both a reflection of what the Prime Minister says is an attack on democracy, although that wasn't a moment of self-reflection. He didn't have Canada in mind when he said it, but I do. The first goes to the Debate Commission, who way overstepped their bounds and dealt a blow to Canada's democracy by blacklisting specific media outlets, most notably the Rebel Media, from asking questions at campaign events, including the leaders' debate during the last fall's federal election. Well, this week, federal judge Justice Elizabeth Hennigan released her written ruling stating that the Debate Commission's ban on Rebel Media to be troubling, unreasonable, procedurally unfair, and lacking in discernible rationality and logic. The logic is, by the way, that the government doesn't like them, and the members of the Debate Commission are all appointees from the government, including We Charity's infamous Craig Kielberger. Judge Hennigan went on to state, in quotes, "There is room in the nation for the expression of opposing points of view. Rebel News did not ask to impose its views, but for the opportunity to participate in coverage of matters of importance during a federal election." I'll just file that under another page of Chronicles to attempt censorship. Second part of the goofy, though, goes to NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, who completely ignored the wishes of 3,036,348 voters who cast their ballots for the NDP in the last election by promising instead to support Prime Minister Trudeau's Liberal government until 2025. The people who voted NDP had every opportunity to vote for the Liberal Party, and they chose not to, whatever their reasons. And now, we're just 7 months later, and Mr. Singh completely, utterly ignores their wishes, which were clearly expressed. I mean, come on, it's more than he thinks he knows better. Voting in an election is the essence of the democratic process. And without consultation, he literally trashed the ballots and overturned their votes. That's all the time we have this week. But before I go, I just want to remind you, I mentioned at the outset of the show, we have a new feature on Money Talks. It's going to be Thursday, April 14th, 6 p.m. Pacific. We're going to have an hour-long Q&A session. I'm going to try and answer as many subscriber questions as I can in a Zoom webinar. Now, it's going to be free for all our Inside Edge subscribers, but the platform only allows for a maximum of 500 participants. So you're going to get an emailed invitation starting, I think it's April 2nd, so make sure you register as soon as you can. And if you're not an Inside Edge subscriber yet, well, there's still lots of times to join. Just go to mikesmoneytalks.ca. You can check out the benefits of the program, including a recent sample of the exclusive content that's there. And while I'm talking about it, I hope you join us on Money Talks Tweet, Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook, and of course, mikesmoneytalks.ca. It's my chance to keep you up to date, but it's also to introduce you to maybe points of view I'm not seeing in the mainstream media. I'll quote other people. I read a ton. I just sort of share some of the best of it. And yeah, it's meant to be provocative, meant to get you thinking. You don't have to agree whatsoever, but the more we know, the better it is. In the meantime, I hope you go out and have a terrific weekend.
This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell, available at mikesmoneytalks.ca or through your favorite podcast subscription service. Join us on Facebook at Michael Campbell's Money Talks and on Twitter at Money Talks Tweet.